Anirul took her position in the center of the chamber. Overhead, a vaulted ceiling spread like a flower to the tops of Gothic stained glass plaz windows. Within each window section, panes contained the family crests of great historical leaders of the order. Fighting back nervousness, Anirul took a deep breath and suppressed the multitude of voices within her. Many of the Bene Gesserit order would not like what she had to say. Though the voices of past lives might offer her comfort and support, she was about to give her own assessment and had to stand by it. She also had to be completely honest. Mother Superior was adept at sensing the slightest deceit. Mother Superior noticed everything, and now her almond eyes flashed with expectation, as well as impatience. Anirul cleared her throat and covered her mouth as she began her report in a directed whisper that carried to the ears of everyone in the sealed room, but nowhere else. Nothing escaped into the ambient air for any concealed listening device. They all knew of her work, but she gave them the details anyway, adding to the import of her announcement. Thousands of years of careful breeding have brought us closer than ever before to our goal. For 90 generations, a plan begun even before the Butlerian warriors led us to freedom from the thinking machines. We of the Sisterhood have planned to create our own weapon, our own super-being, who will bridge space and time with his mind. Her words droned on. The other Bene Gesserit did not stir, though they appeared bored with her standard summary of the project. Very well, I will give them something to awaken their hopes. With the dance of DNA, I have determined we are at most only 3 generations removed from success. Her pulse accelerated. Soon, we will have our Kwisatz Haderach. Take care when you speak of this secret of all secrets, Mother Superior warned. But her delight could not be covered by her sternness. I take care with every aspect of our program, Mother Superior, Anirul countered, in too haughty a tone. She caught herself, kept her narrow face expressionless, but others had already seen the slip. There would be more murmurings about her brashness, her youth and unsuitability for such an important role. That is why I am so certain of what we must do. The gene samples have been analyzed, all possibilities projected. The path is plainer now than ever before. So many sisters before her had worked toward this incredible goal, and now it was her duty to administer the final breeding decisions and supervise the birth and upbringing of a new girl child, who would in all probability be the grandmother of the Kwisatz Haderach himself. I have the names of the final genetic pairings, Anirul announced. Our mating index indicates that these will produce the highest likelihood of success. She paused, savoring the absolute attention the others paid to her. To any outsider, Anirul appeared to be no more than another reverend mother, indistinguishable from the rest of her sisters, and not terribly talented or gifted in any way. The Bene Gesserit were good at keeping secrets, and the Kwisatz mother was one of the greatest of these. We need a particular bloodline from an ancient house. This will produce a daughter, our equivalent to the mother of the Virgin Mary, who must then take the mate we choose. These two will be the grandparents, and their offspring, also a daughter, will be trained here on Wallach 9. This Bene Gesserit woman will become the mother of our Kwisatz Haderach, a boy child to be raised by us under our complete control. Anirul let out her last words with a slow sigh and considered the immensity of what she had said. Only a few decades more, and the astounding birth would occur, potentially within Anirul's lifetime. thinking back through the tunnels of other memory, grasping the canvas of time that had spread out in preparation for this event. Anirul realized how lucky she was to be alive now, in this period of time. Her predecessors stood in a spectral line inside her mind, eagerly watching and waiting. When the unparalleled breeding program finally came to fruition, the Bene Gesserit would no longer need to remain a subtle, manipulative presence in the politics of the Imperium. Everything would belong to them, and the archaic galactic feudal system would fall. Though no one spoke, Anirul detected concern in the hawkish eyes of her sisters, bordering on a doubt that none of them dared express. "And what is this bloodline?" Mother Superior asked. Anirul did not hesitate, drew herself taller. "We must have a daughter by the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen." She read the surprise on their faces. Harkonnens? They had been part of the overall breeding programs, of course. All Landsrad houses were. But no one would have imagined the Bene Gesserit savior springing from the seed of such a man. What did such a lineage bode for the Kwisatz Haderach? Given a Harkonnen-bred superman, could the Bene Gesserit hope to control him? All of these questions, and many more, passed between the sisters, without the utterance of a sound or even a directed whisper. Anirul saw it plainly. "As all of you know," she said at last, "the Baron Harkonnen is a dangerously cunning and manipulative man. Though we can be certain he is generally aware of the numerous Bene Gesserit breeding programs, our plan cannot be revealed. Still, we must find a way for him to impregnate a chosen sister without telling him why." Mother Superior pursed her wrinkled lips. "The Baron's sexual appetites run exclusively to men and boys. He will have no interest in accepting a female lover, especially not one thrust upon him by us." Anirul nodded soberly. "Our seductive abilities will be taxed as never before." She gave a challenging look to the powerful Reverend Mothers in attendance. "But I have no doubt that with all the resources of the Bene Gesserit, we will find a way to coerce him." In response to the strict but Lyrian taboo against machines that perform mental functions, a number of schools developed enhanced human beings to subsume most of the functions formerly performed by computers. Some of the key schools arising out of the jihad include the Bene Gesserit, with their intense mental and physical training, the Spacing Guild, with the prescient ability to find a safe path through fold space, and the Mentats, whose computer-like minds are capable of extraordinary acts of reasoning. Iqban's Treatise on the Mind, Volume 1. As he made ready to depart from home for an entire year, Leto tried to hold on to his self-confidence. He knew this was an important step for him, and understood why his father had chosen Ix as a place to study. But he would still miss Caladan terribly. It was not the young ducal heir's first trip to a different star system. Leto and his father had explored the multiple worlds of Gar and the fog-bound planet of Pilargo, where Caladanian primitives were thought to have originated. Those had been mere outings, exciting sightseeing trips. However, the prospect of going away for so long, and all alone, made him worry more than he'd expected. He didn't dare show it, though. "I will be Duke some day." Dressed in Atreides' finery, Leto stood with the old Duke at the Kala Municipal Spaceport, awaiting a shuttle that would carry him to a guild highliner. Two suspensor-borne suitcases hovered near his feet. His mother had suggested he take retainers, cargo cases full of garments and diversions, and supplies of good Caledonian food. Duke Paulus, on the other hand, had laughed and explained how, when he was Leto's age, he'd survived for months on the battlefield with only the few possessions and a pack on his back. He did, however, insist that Leto take one of Caladan's traditional fishing knives in a sheath at his back. Siding with his father, as usual, Leto chose to be minimal in his packing. Besides, Ix was a rich industrial planet, not a wilderness. He wouldn't suffer many privations during his schooling. When anyone could see her, the Lady Helena bore the decision with stoic good grace. Now she stood beside the departure group, dressed in fine robes and a shimmering cape. Though he knew his mother genuinely feared for his well-being, Lady Atreides would never show anything but the most perfect public face. Adjusting the oil lenses of his father's field glasses, Leto peered away from the shifting pastels of the dawn horizon, up into the vestiges of night. A glinting speck moved against the stars. When he touched the zoom pad, the speck grew until Leto recognized a highliner in low orbit, surrounded by the shimmering blur of a shield defensive system. "Do you see it?" Paulus asked, standing at his son's shoulder. "It's there, with full shields activated. Are they worried about military action? Here?" With such severe political and economic consequences, Leto couldn't imagine anyone attacking a guild craft. Although the Spacing Guild had no military power of its own, it could, through withdrawal of transportation services, cripple any solar system. And with elaborate surveillance mechanisms, the guild could trace and identify rogue attackers and send messages off to the Emperor, who in turn would dispatch Imperial Sardaukar according to mutual treaty. "Never underestimate the tactics of desperation, lad," Paulus said, but did not elaborate further. From time to time he had told his son stories of trumped-up charges against particular people, situations fabricated in the past in order to wipe out enemies of the Emperor or the Guild. Leto thought that of all the things he was leaving behind, he would miss his father's insights most, the old Duke's brief and perceptive lessons tossed off the cuff. "The Empire functions beyond mere laws," Paulus continued. "An equally strong foundation is the network of alliances, favors, and religious propaganda. Beliefs are more powerful than facts." Leto stared through the thick sky at the magnificent distant ship and frowned. It was often difficult to separate truth from fiction. He watched a speck of orange appear below the immense orbiting craft. The color became a streak of descending light that resolved into the shape of a shuttle, which soon hovered over the Kala landing field. Four white gulls whipped around, soaring in the stirred air currents from the shuttle's descent, then flew shrieking out to the sea cliffs. Around the shuttle, a shield shimmered and flickered off. All along the spaceport fences, pennants snapped in a salty morning breeze. The shuttle, a white bullet-shaped craft, floated across the field toward the embarkation platform on which Leto and his parents stood separate from the honor guard. A crowd of onlookers and well-wishers waved and shouted from the outskirts of the landing field. The craft and platform connected, and a door slid open in the fuselage. His mother came forward to say her goodbyes, embracing him without words. She had threatened simply to watch from one of the towers in Castle Caladan, but Paulus had convinced her otherwise. The crowd cheered and shouted their farewells. Duke Paulus and Lady Helena stood hand in hand and waved back at them. "Remember what I told you, son," Paulus said, referring to intense counseling he had given the boy in recent days. "Learn from Ix. Learn from everything." "But use your heart to know what is true," his mother added. "Always," he said. "I'll miss you both. I'll make you proud of me. We already are, lad. The older man stepped back to the formal guard escort. He exchanged Atreides' salutes with his son, an open right hand beside the temple, and all the soldiers did the same. Then Paulus bounded forward to give Leto a hearty hug. Moments later, the robo-piloted shuttle rose away from the black cliffs, churning seas, and cloud-wreathed croplands of Caladan. Inside, Leto sat in a plush chair in the observation lounge, peering out a window port. As the craft reached the indigo darkness of space, he saw the metallic island of the Guild Highliner with sunlight glinting off its surface. At their approach, a yawning black hole opened in the underside. Leto took a deep breath, and the immense ship swallowed the shuttle. He envisioned what he had once seen in a film book about Arrakis, a sandworm inhaling a spice harvester. The metaphor unsettled him. The shuttle slid smoothly into the docking port of a Waku passenger ship that hung in its designated berth inside the cavernous hold of the Highliner. Leto boarded, his suitcases floating along behind, and made up his mind to do as his father had instructed. Learn from everything. His determined curiosity pushing his intimidation aside, Leto climbed a stairway to the main passenger lounge, where he found a seat on a bench by another window. Two Soustone merchants sat nearby, their rapid conversation sprinkled with jargon. Old Paulus had wanted Leto to learn how to fend for himself. So, to enhance the experience, Leto was traveling as an ordinary passenger, with no special amenities, no pomp or entourage, no indication that he was the son of a duke. His mother had been horrified. Aboard the ship, Waku vendors wearing dark glasses and ear-clamp headsets moved from passenger to passenger, selling confections and perfumed beverages at exorbitant prices. Leto waved off a persistent vendor, though the spicy, salty broths and broiled meat sticks smelled delicious. He could hear an overflow of music from the man's headset, saw his head, shoulders, and feet moving to the beat of music piped into his skull. The Waku did their jobs, tended to the customers, but managed to live in their own sensory cacophony. They preferred the universe within to any spectacle they might experience outside. This mass transit craft, operated by the Waku under guild contract, carried passengers from system to system. A disgraced House Major, whose planets had all been destroyed in the Third Coal Sack War, the Waku were gypsies now and lived as nomads aboard Guild Highliners. Although ancient surrender terms prevented members of their race from setting foot on any planet in the Imperium, the Guild had, for undisclosed reasons, granted them sanctuary. For generations, the Waku had showed no interest in petitioning the Emperor for amnesty or a revocation of the severe restrictions placed upon them. Looking through the window of the lounge, Leto saw the dimly illuminated cargo hold of the Highliner, a vacuum chamber so large that this passenger ship was, by comparison, even smaller than a grain of pundi rice in the belly of a fish. He could see the ceiling high overhead, but not the walls kilometers away. Other ships, large and small, were arrayed in the hold. Frigates, cargo haulers, shuttles, lighters, and armored monitors. Strapped together stacks of dump boxes, unpiloted cargo containers designed to dump material directly from low orbit onto a planet's surface, hung next to the main exterior hatches. Guild regulations, etched on Redulian crystals mounted to the main wall of every room, prohibited passengers from leaving the isolation of their ship. Through adjacent windows, Leto snatched glimpses of passengers inside other craft, a potpourri of races bound for all parts of the Imperium. The Waku deckhands finished their first round of service, and the passengers waited. The trip through Fold Space took no more than an hour, but preparations for departure sometimes required days. Finally, with no announcement whatsoever, Leto detected a faint, smooth purring that seemed to come from far away. He could feel it in every muscle of his body. "We must be heading out," he said, turning to the Soustone merchants, who seemed unimpressed. From the quick diverting of their eyes and the way they studiously ignored him, Leto thought they must consider him an uncultured yokel. In an isolated chamber high atop the craft, a guild navigator, swimming in a tank of gas, saturated with melange, began to encompass space with his mind. He envisioned and threaded a safe passage through the fabric of Fold Space, transporting the Highliner and its contents across a vast distance. At dinner the previous evening in the castle's dining hall, Leto's mother had wondered aloud if navigators might somehow violate the machine-human interaction prohibited by the Butlerian Jihad. Knowing Leto would soon be off to Ix and at risk of moral tainting, she innocently made the suggestion as she nibbled on a mouthful of lemon-broiled fish. She often used a most reasonable tone when she uttered her provocative statements. The effect was like dropping a boulder into a pool of still water. "Oh, nonsense, Helena," Paulus said, wiping his beard with a napkin. "Where would we be without navigators?"
"Just because you have become accustomed to a thing does not make it right, Paulus. The Orange Catholic Bible says nothing about morality being defined by personal convenience."
Before his father could argue the point, Leto interrupted. "I thought that navigators just saw the way, a safe way. Holtzman generators actually operate the spacecraft." He decided to add a quote he remembered from the Bible. "The highest master in the material world is the human mind, and the beasts of the field and the machines of the city must be forever subordinate."
"Of course, dear," his mother said, and dropped the subject.
Now he didn't notice any change of sensation upon passing into Fold Space. Before Leto knew it, the Highliner arrived in another solar system, Harmonthep, according to the transport schedule. Once there, Leto had to wait for 5 more hours as cargo ships and shuttles went in and out of the Highliner hold, as well as transports and even a super frigate. Then the guild ship moved off again, folding space to a new solar system, Kirana Aleph this time, where the cycle occurred once more. Leto took a nap in the sleeping compartments, then emerged to buy 2 of the sizzling meat sticks and a potent cup of stea. Helena might wish he'd been escorted by Atreides' house guards, but Paulus had insisted that there was only one way for his son to learn to take care of himself. Leto had an agenda and instructions, and he vowed to do just that. Finally, on the third stop, a Waku deckhand ordered Leto to descend 3 decks and board an automatic shuttle. She was a stern-looking woman in a gaudy uniform and did not seem to be in the mood for conversation. Her headset thrummed with an undercurrent of melody.
"Is this Ix?" Leto inquired, reaching for his Suspenser Boyd suitcases. They followed him as he moved.
"We are in the Alcarop system," she said. Her eyes couldn't be seen because of her dark glasses. "Ix is the 9th planet. You get off here. We've already jettisoned the dump boxes." Leto did as he was instructed, making his way toward the indicated shuttle, though he wished he had been given more warning and more information. He didn't know exactly what he was supposed to do once he arrived on the high-tech industrial world, but he assumed Earl Vernius would greet him, or at least send some sort of welcoming party. He took a deep breath and tried not to let his anxiety grow too intense.
The robo-piloted shuttle plummeted out of the highliner hold toward the surface of a planet traced with mountains, clouds, and ice. The automated shuttle functioned according to a limited set of instructions, and conversation wasn't in its repertoire of skills. Leto was the only passenger aboard, apparently the only traveler bound for Ix. The machine planet welcomed few visitors. As he looked out the porthole, though, Leto had a sinking feeling that something had gone wrong. The Waku shuttle approached a high mountain plateau with alpine forests in sheltered valleys. He saw no buildings, none of the grand structures or manufacturing facilities he had expected. No smoke in the air, no cities, no sign of civilization at all. This couldn't possibly be the heavily industrialized world of Ix. He looked around, tensing up, ready to defend himself. Had he been betrayed? Lured here and stranded? The shuttle came to a stop on a stark plain strewn with flecked granite boulders and small clumps of white flowers. "This is where you get out, sir," the robopilot announced in a synthesized voice. "Where are we?" Leto demanded. "I'm supposed to be going to the capital of Ix." "This is where you get out, sir." "Answer me." His father would have used a booming voice to wrench a reply from this stupid machine. "This can't be the capital city of Ix. Just look around you." "You have 10 seconds to exit the craft, sir, or you will be forcibly ejected. The guild operates on a tight schedule. The Highliner is already prepared to depart for the next system." Cursing under his breath, Leto nudged his drifting luggage and stepped onto the rubble-strewn surface. Within seconds, the white, bullet-shaped craft rose and dwindled to a pinpoint of orange light in the sky, before it disappeared from view entirely. His pair of suitcases hovered beside him, and a clean-smelling wind ruffled his hair. Leto was alone. "Hello?" he shouted, but no one answered. He shivered as he stared at rugged mountain ridges dusted with snow and glacial ice. Caladan, mostly an ocean world, had very few mountains approaching this grandeur. But he had not come to see mountains. "Hello! I'm Leto Atreides from Caladan," he called out. "Is anyone here?" A sick feeling clenched his chest. He was far from home on an unknown world, with no way to find out where in the vast universe he was. Is this even Ix? The brisk wind was cold and sharp, but the open plain remained eerily quiet. Oppressive silence hung in the thin air. He had spent his life hearing the lullaby of the ocean, the songs of gulls, and the bustle of villagers. Here he saw nothing, no welcoming party, no signs of habitation. The world looked untouched, empty. "If I've been stranded here, will anyone be able to find me?" Thickening clouds concealed the sky, though he saw a distant blue sun through a break in the cover. He shivered again and wondered what he should do, where he should go. If he was going to be a duke, he had to learn to make decisions. A drizzle of sleet began to fall. The paintbrush of history has depicted Abelard Harkonnen in a most unfavorable light. Judged by the standards of his older half-brother, Baron Vladimir, and his own children, Glossu Rabban and Fade Rautha Rabban, Abelard was a different sort of man entirely. We must, however, assess the frequent descriptions of his weakness, incompetence, and foolhardy decisions in light of the ultimate failure of House Harkonnen. Though exiled to Lankeveil and stripped of any real power, Abelard secured a victory unmatched by anyone else in his extended family. He learned how to be happy with his life. Landsrad Encyclopedia of Great Houses, post Jihad Edition.
Though the Harkonnens were formidable foes in the arena of manipulations, subterfuge, and disinformation, the Bene Gesserit were undisputed masters. In order to achieve the next step in their grand breeding scheme, a plan that had been in place since 10 generations before the downfall of thinking machines, the sisterhood needed to find a fulcrum that would make the Baron bend to their will. It didn't take them long to figure out the weak point in House Harkonnen. Presenting herself as a new domestic servant on cold and blustery Lankavile, the young Bene Gesserit sister Margit Rashino Zia infiltrated the household of Abelard Harkonnen, the Baron's younger half-brother. Beautiful Margit, hand-selected by Kwisatz's mother Anirul, had been trained in the ways of spying and ferreting out information, of connecting mismatched tidbits of data to construct a broader picture. She also knew 63 ways to kill a human being using nothing but her fingers. The sisterhood worked hard to maintain their appearance as brooding intellectuals, but they also had their commandos. Sister Margit was counted among their best. The lodge house of Abelard Harkonnen sat on a rugged spit of land that extended into deep water, bordered by narrow Tula Fjord. A fishing village surrounded the wooden mansion. Farms pushed inland into the thin and rocky valleys. But most of the planet's food supply came from the frigid sea. Lankavile's economy was based on the rich whale fur industry. Abelard lived at the base of dripping mountains, whose tops were rarely seen through the looming steel-gray clouds and lingering mist. The main house and surrounding village was the closest thing to a capital center this frontier world had to offer. Since strangers were rare, Margit took precautions not to be noticed. She stood taller than many of the stocky and muscular natives, so she disguised herself with a slight stoop. She dyed her honey-blonde hair dark and cut it thick and shaggy, a style favored by many of the villagers. With chemicals, she treated her smooth, pale skin to make it weathered and lend it a darker cast. She blended in, and everyone accepted her without a second glance. For a woman trained by the sisterhood, maintaining the sham was easy. Margit was only one of numerous Bene Gesserit spies dispatched to the widespread Harkonnen holdings, where they would surreptitiously scour any and all business records. The Baron had no reason to suspect such scrutiny at this time. He'd had very few dealings with the sisterhood. But if any of their female spies were discovered, the lean and vicious man would have no compunctions against torturing them for explanations. Luckily, Margot thought, any well-trained Bene Gesserit could stop her own heart long before inflicted pain could force her to reveal secrets. Traditionally, the Harkonnens were adept at manipulation and concealment, but Margot knew she would find the necessary incriminating evidence. Though other sisters had argued for digging closer to the heart of Harkonnen operations, Margit had concluded that Abelard would make the perfect patsy. The younger Harkonnen demi-brother had, after all, run the spice operations on Arrakis for 7 years. He must have some information. If anything needed to be hidden, the Baron would likely do it here, unexpectedly, right under Abelard's nose. Once the Bene Gesserit uncovered a few of the Harkonnen's mistakes and held proof of the Baron's financial indiscretions, they would have the blackmail weapon so desperately needed to advance their breeding program. Dressed as an indigenous villager in dyed wools and furs, Margit slipped into the rustic great house at the docks. The structure stood tall and was composed of massive wood, stained dark. Fireplaces in every room filled the air with resinous smoke, and glow globes, tuned to yellow-orange, did their best to approximate sunlight. Margot cleaned. She dusted. She helped with the cooking. She searched
for financial records. 2 days in a row, the Baron's amiable half-brother greeted her, smiling, welcoming. He noticed nothing whatsoever amiss. A trusting sort, he seemed unconcerned for his own safety, and allowed locals and strangers to wander into the main rooms and guest quarters of his mansion, even close to his person. He had gray-blonde hair, long to his shoulders, and a seamed, ruddy face that was disarmed by a perpetual half-smile. It was said that he'd been a favorite of his father Dmitri, who had encouraged Abelard to take over the Harkonnen holdings. But Abelard had made so many bad choices, so many decisions based on people rather than business necessities. It had been his downfall. Wearing warm and prickly Lankavile clothing, Margit kept her gray-green eyes downcast and concealed behind lenses that made them appear brown. She could have made herself into a golden-haired beauty, and had, in fact, considered seducing Abelard and simply taking the information she needed. But she had decided against that plan. The man seemed unshakably devoted to his squat and wholesome native wife, Emmy Rabban, the mother of Glossu Rabban. He had fallen in love with her long ago on Lankavile, married her to the dismay of his father, and carried her with him from world to world during his chaotic career. Abelard seemed impervious to any feminine temptations but hers. Instead, Margit used simple charm and quiet innocence to gain access to written financial records, dusty ledgers, and inventory rooms. No one questioned her. In time, taking advantage of every surreptitious opportunity, she found what she needed. Using flash memorization techniques learned on Wallach 9, Margit scanned through stacks of etched Redulian crystals and absorbed columns of numbers, cargo manifests, lists of equipment decommissioned or placed into service, suspicious losses, storm damage. In nearby rooms, groups of women skinned and gutted fish, chopped herbs, peeled roots and sour fruits for steaming cauldrons of fish stew, which Abelard and his wife served for the entire household. They insisted on eating the same meals, at the same tables, as all of their workers. Margit finished her surreptitious scanning well before the meal call sounded throughout the rooms of the great house. Later, in private, while listening to a blustery storm outside, she reviewed the data in her mind and studied spice production records from Abelard's tenure on Arrakis and the Baron's current filings with Choam, along with the amounts of melange spirited away from Arrakis by various smuggler organizations. Normally, she would have set aside the data until entire teams of sisters had had a chance to analyze it. But Margit wanted to discover the answer herself. Pretending to sleep, she dived into the problem behind her eyelids with abandon, falling into a deep trance. The numbers had been masterfully manipulated, but after Margit stripped away the masks and thin screens, she found her answer. A Bene Gesserit could see it, but she doubted even the Emperor's financial advisors or Choam accountants would detect the deception. Unless it was pointed out to them. Her discovery suggested serious underreporting of spice production to Choam and the Emperor. Either the Harkonnens were selling melange illicitly, doubtful because that could easily be tracked, or accumulating secret stockpiles of their own. Interesting, Margit thought, raising her eyebrows. She opened her eyes, went over to a reinforced window casement, and stared out at the liquid metal seas, the choppy waves trapped within the bottleneck fjords, the murky black clouds hovering above the rugged bulwarks of rock. In the bleak distance, fur whales set up an eerie, humming song. The following day, she booked passage on the next Guild Highliner. Then, shucking her disguise, she rode up in a cargo hauler filled with processed whale fur. She doubted that anyone on Lankavile had noticed her arrival or her departure. Four things cannot be hidden: love, smoke, a pillar of fire, and a man striding across the open bled. Freeman Wisdom. Alone in the quiet, stark desert. Exactly as it should be. Pardot Kynes found that he worked best with nothing but his own thoughts and plenty of time to think them. Other people provided too many distractions, and few others had the same focus or the same drive. As imperial planetologist to Arrakis, he needed to absorb the huge landscape into every pore of his being. Once he got into the right mindset, he could actually feel the pulse of a world. Now, standing atop a rugged formation of black and red rock that had been uplifted from the surrounding basin, the lean, weathered man stared in both directions at the vastness. Desert. Desert everywhere. His map screen named the mountainous line Rimwall West. His altimeter proclaimed the tallest peaks to be substantially higher than 6,000 meters. Yet he saw no snow, glaciers, or ice. No sign of precipitation whatsoever. Even the most rugged and atomic-blasted mountaintops on Seleucus Secundus had been covered with snow. But the air here was so desperately dry that exposed water could not survive in any form. Kynes stared southward across the ocean of sand to the world-girdling desert known as the Funeral Plain. No doubt geographers could have found ample distinctions to categorize the landscape into further labeled subsections. But few humans who ventured out there ever returned. This was the domain of the worms. No one really needed maps. Bemused, Kynes remembered ancient sailing charts from the earliest days of old Terra, their mysterious, unexplored areas marked simply, "Here be monsters." Yes, he thought as he recalled Rabban's hunt of the incredible sandworm. Here be monsters, indeed. Exposed atop the serrated ridge of the rim wall, he removed the stillsuit's nostril plugs and rubbed a sore spot where the filter constantly brushed against his nose. Then he pulled away the covering on his mouth so he could take a deep breath of the scorched, brittle air. According to his desert prep instructions, he knew he should not expose himself unnecessarily to such water loss, but Kynes needed to draw in the aromas and vibrations of Arrakis, needed to sense the heartbeat of the planet. He smelled hot dust, the subtle saltiness of minerals, the distinct tastes of sand, weathered lava, and basalt. This was a world entirely without the moist scents of either growing or rotting vegetation, without any odor that might betray the cycles of life and death. Only sand and rock and more sand. Upon closer inspection, though, even the harshest desert teemed with life, with specialized plants, with animals and insects adapted to hostile ecological niches. He knelt to scrutinize shadowy pockets in the rock, tiny hollows where the barest breath of morning dew might collect. There, lichens gripped the rough stone surface. A few hard pellets marked the droppings of a small rodent, perhaps a kangaroo rat.